Hundred B shall take in text number 35, calculation of time from the atom. Upward by his divine grace, AC Bhaktivinoda Swami Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki. Translation. In the beginning of the first half of Brahma's life, there was an millennium called Brahma Kalpa, wherein Lord Brahma appeared. The birth of the Vedas was simultaneous with Brahma's birth. Translation responsibly. In the beginning of the first half of Brahma's life, there was a millennium called Brahma Kalpa, wherein Lord Brahma appeared. The birth of the Vedas was simultaneous with Brahma's birth. According to Padma Purana, Prabhasapanda, in 30 days of Brahma, many kalpas take place, such as the Varaha Kalpa and Pitru Kalpa. 30 days make 1 month of Brahma, beginning from the full moon to the disappearance of the moon. 12 such months complete 1 year, and 50 years complete one purana, or one half the duration of the life of Brahma. The Shraddha Varaha appearance of the Lord is the first birthday of Brahma. The birth date of Brahma is in the month of March, according to Hindu astronomical calculation. The statement is reproduced from the explanation of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Om Adhyanatimanasya Janamashwaraya Chakshumiritamya Tasmaya Shri Gurvindu Shri Chaitanya Mahavishnam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Kalkamanam Padati Swapitam Vancha Kalkarta Vishwara Prasam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Prabhupada Shiva Sadi Yoga Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare
Hare Krishna. So we are continuing this conversation between Maitreya and Madhura, in which different subtopics have been given. In the beginning of this calculation of time from the atom, we're hearing the different perspectives of time from text 1 to 15, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And then further on, there are more descriptions or longer durations of time calculated according to the different planetary systems, different living entities. And then now we're going through different phases of Lord Brahma and mentioning of different devastations that may happen at the end of Brahma's night, his life, etc. So these are all within this one chapter. These subtopics are in this one chapter. So we know that at the present moment, Lord Brahma is in the second half of his life. That is mentioned in a few purports in this chapter. Although he's living for 311 trillion, 40 billion solar years, his life also will come to an end. So for us, this 311 trillion, 40 billion years, it sounds very tempting, because we understand that those who are on the Brahmaloka planet at the time of devastation, they are elevated to higher spiritual planets. They are not annihilated. They go along with Lord Brahma according to their desire as well. They are put into other higher planets, or they go back to Godhead. But this is based on their desire. I think this is mentioned in one of the purports that I wanted to mention, because I found it quite interesting. I found it very important, actually. This is a commentary by Srila Swami on the verse explaining the life of Lord Brahma and how it also just seems like a moment in relevance to eternal time.
So in the 8th chapter, explaining how to attain the Supreme, the verse Ahanabhumba Loka, Punava Avartana Arjuna, Mamukecha Tukunteya, Pumud Jamana Vijete. From the highest planets in the material world down to the lowest are all places of misery where irrepeated birth and death take place. But one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So in this verse, the processes of Srila Prabhupada explains how even for the process of jnana, karma, apriya, whatever it may be, eventually one has to attain devotional service in bhakti yoga in order to complete that perfection so that they don't return to this material world wherein they have to take repeated birth and death. So in here, Srila Prabhupada has given a commentary by Srila Sridhar Swami who explains that when there is devastation of this material universe, Brahma and his devotees who are constantly engaged in Krishna consciousness are all transferred to the spiritual universe and to specific spiritual planets according to their desires. So our transportation from the material realm to whether it's lower or higher planetary systems is based on the desire that we have. Are we desiring to serve Krishna, or are we still attracted or attached to being in this material world? So even in the post of Lord Brahma, who is living for millions and billions of years, his time must come and he must also exit and transport himself based on his pure desire, of course, hopefully, to the spiritual universe, to the spiritual realm. So in the material world, there's a saying that, what do they say out here? Survival of the fittest. But actually, no one survives in the material world. You have to keep changing your bodies. So to properly survive the onslaughts of Maya, the ropes of material nature, one has to actually make an exit out of the material cosmos altogether and go to the eternal abode. That is Satchidananda. So leaving this material existence means we don't have to come back and take repeated birth and death, be it in the middle planetary system or the upper planetary systems. Both are places of misery. Different tastes and different flavors. The most miserable condition, of course, for the living entity is that we are separated from our pure consciousness. We are separated from our service attitude towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that is the biggest tragedy we are facing in the material world. We might be in the celestial planets, we might be in subterranean heavenly planets, we might be in the middle planetary system, but we are subjected to the time factor, which will take away the body, which will take away our material existence over and over and over again, putting us in the wombs of different living entities so we can once again try to play God in the material universe. So just last week I had a scout group who came to the temple on Saturday, and it's very interesting that people are attracted to the concept of becoming animals. So similarly, once His Holiness Devaraja Swami was doing a talk at Mantra Lounge, and he was asking the students what their concept of happiness and freedom is, and most of them just wanted to be a horse or a bird or something so they can run with the wind, they can fly as they please, they can sleep, they can become fish. So actually people are very much attracted to animals, to becoming animals in their next life. They just came to the concept of reincarnation without explaining that you don't only live once, you are eternal. Your body can keep changing based on whatever karma you're performing. And they started asking, oh, so can I become a bird? Like, you can become a bird, you can become an ant if you want. You can become, one of them wanted to become a turtle. I don't know why. But you could see the understanding of suffering is very, very different. They see the ability of birds to fly and fish to just live in water as freedom. But we understand that, you know, real freedom means that one is not controlled by the senses, that one actually becomes a ghost swami and controls the senses. That is how one attains freedom. The minute our senses abuse us in this body, we have no freedom. We are controlled by our senses. As we can see out there, people are controlled by the external energy. People are controlled by the idea that they are the body, and therefore their sense of touch, their sense of taste, their sense of seeing or hearing controls them. So they do not have the stability or the strength to actually get a grip of themselves and be in this material world and make the best use of their human life. So people see suffering very, very differently. Sometimes we even see in urban yoga, we explain how old age is suffering, how disease, you're in a suffering condition, and people disagree. They say, no, this is fine, it's beautiful to age. It's beautiful when you go through something, you come out and you feel great, you feel like a new person, you've got rid of whatever disease. So they actually do not see that as suffering. And it is a very, very sad state that people do not see the basic, you know, suffering in this world. They see it as something pleasurable. Right? This is, you know, the mode of ignorance fueled by passion. So most lives of people in this world is actually ruled by ignorance, and to stay in the ignorance, they act very passionately. They act very passionately to gratify their gross and subtle senses so that they go deeper and deeper into ignorance. So most people are actually very, very much ignorant. So of course it will be difficult for them to try to understand what suffering actually is. Or to speak of explaining what their true self or their true nature is, the fact that they can't get off the suffering platform is a great disaster for a human being. So this attachment to the body, this attachment to the identity that we are just the external manifestation, puts people in a whole lot of anxiety, and it makes them extremely less intelligent. So a friend of mine who comes to Urban Yoga was telling me how she showed me a news article from China, how people are so attached to their body, their bodily image, seeing that as the absolute truth. They perform lots of plastic surgery. So we all know what plastic surgery is, right? Yes? Fixing things by injecting stuff in you or whatever. Collagen, blah, blah, blah. So there's a trend that people are not satisfied with their material body, and they have no idea that the material body cannot be perfect. The material body will never be perfect, no matter how much plastic surgery, because the material body means beginning, middle, and end. It is going to vanish at some point. As we heard yesterday, the satvikars, the six changes that happen to every single material, every single being. You are born, you stay for some time, you produce some by-products, you start dwindling, and then you vanish. So that is common to all of us. That is common to every single type of body. So when they perform plastic surgery, they're trying to go up against material nature. They're trying to play God. Because only Krishna can step in front of the material energy, and it can't touch him. The material energy will inflict pain on us. The material energy never takes a vacation. Like, there are no vacations in this material world. Like, misery will happen. The tamagun, rajagun is always there. They don't go on vacation. They do not go on a hiatus, or they do not go on a 6-month sabbatical somewhere and leave the living entities in the material world to just enjoy in pseudo-sattva. It's not happening. So in the material world, we are going to be subjected to all sorts of things. So anyway, in this article, it was explaining the natural, or should I say the normal condition of living entities in this age, of wanting to perfect the material body, which cannot be perfected. And this they do by artificial means called plastic surgery,
in which they're trying to change their bodily image. So this husband and wife had changed their looks altogether. There was a before and after picture, and you couldn't even recognize that who these two people were, but it was one person. So the eyes, of course, were widened, new cheeks, new chin, new nose, new eyes. The husband did the same, and then they had children. And then the children, you know, sometimes due to our karma, we understand that good karma results in one having beautiful body features, good education, intelligence, etc. So the children did not look particularly beautiful. They were really not beautiful, but I'm not saying that in a negative, in a bad way. But the children weren't, they were a little bit on the ugly side. So the husband divorced the wife for giving him ugly children, and the husband is suing the wife for having produced ugly children. Now this is very, very, this is a level of stupidity that I've never heard of. So this is what's happening in the material world, that our insane attachment to our bodily or external form is seen as the absolute truth. There's no turning back. But although we are witnessing the sudden changes of the body every single day, yet we still want to remain attached to the body that we have. We still want to pamper the body. We still conjugate ideas of what this body is going to do for me eternally. But this body is going to die at some point. Then we are transported somewhere else based on our actions. So this is a very, very interesting point, that time is right behind us. Time is right there. Time is going to act on every single living entity. And it depends on what type of consciousness we have to understand the value of time. So one who lives in Krishna consciousness understands time not in a negative way, but in a way that I'm getting one step closer to attaining my perfection. I'm getting closer to Krishna. That is how we can view time. We can have a very, very long or extended vision of time, in terms that we can see that eventually this time factor is pushing us towards our goal in life. At the end of life, we're not striving to read our bank balance on our deathbed or to be in our fancy car, but we're striving to be in Krishna consciousness. That is our goal, that is what we want to achieve. So time can be used in a very, very positive way by the devotee to attain perfection. Not to try to cheat time by manipulating things around us to keep us here, because time waits for no man. Time will always act. And no matter how many millions one may have, the time factor cannot be bought. You cannot buy 10 years of your life. They say you can look 10 years younger. That doesn't mean you're not going to vanish. You might look 15 years younger, but the time factor is still going to act. So that was, I found that very, very interesting, that those who are afraid of time, those who do not understand how Krishna is the controller of time, try to fight with time, try to battle with time, and they try to control time in such a way that they would like to manipulate time for their sense gratification. Now, we are attached to this body, therefore this body cannot go. Therefore, we will construct many means and ways to actually enjoy and be in this body, no matter what the time factor says or does. So this is a sad state of affairs, actually. So in this translation, we're hearing of the appearance of the Varaha incarnation of the Lord. In the 13th, 14th chapter, these pastimes are going to be explained even more. Pregnancy of deity in the evening, appearance of Lord Varaha in the 13th chapter.
So it's explained by Srila Prabhupada that this varaha kalpa happens in the first manvantara and in the sixth manvantara. So in the first manvantara, the varaha deity, the Lord Bor, he's appearing. That's the first day of Lord Brahma in the Chakshusha millennium. He appears from the nostril of Lord Brahma. So in the past, when we hear that Lord Brahma was actually, it will come later on in more depth, when Lord Brahma was thinking about how to save the universe, how to populate it properly, because the universe had sunk down to the Gavalaka Ocean. As he was thinking, Lord Bor appeared from his nostril, and he was the size. It says the size of a thumb. And then gradually he grew and grew, and he went into the sky, into the ether, and then he, of course, fully manifested. Decorated as anything. So this is our Lord Bor. Some people might think this is very strange, God appearing as a hawk. But he was a very, very decked out, transcendental Lord Varaha. So he appeared from the nostril of Lord Brahma, and he rescued the earth from the bottom of the ocean, and he fought with Hiranyaksha. In this millennium, in this Manvantara, he had fought with Hiranyaksha, and he was red. His color was red. But in the sixth Manvantara, Varaha is appearing from the procreation of Diti and Kashyapa Muni, and his form is whitish, and he still appears to rescue the earth, etc. So this is in Swayambhuva Manu's time. So these pastimes are going to be explained later on. I won't get much into depth. But here, in this conversation between Maitreya and Vidura, in this section, Maitreya will present both pastimes into one. But later on, they will be separated and they'll be explained separately. So in both instances, when Lord Varaha appeared in the first Manvantara, the sixth Manvantara, he came to rescue the earth. And here it's explaining some technicalities regarding the Brahma's kalpa, Varaha kalpa, Pitri kalpa, etc. It's a bit of a mind-boggler. But it explains that the 30 days of Brahma begin with the waxing moons. And then with names such as Shreta, Varaha, etc., and then it ends with the Pitri Kalpa. So these 30 days make a month, and then 12, of course, make a year, and 50 years make a Parata. So the first day in the first Parata is called Brahma Kalpa, or the Shreta, Varaha, Kalpa. And this Pitri Kalpa that's being referred to happens at the end of the first half of Brahma's life, and it's sometimes called Padma Kalpa. So in every Kalpa, in every day of Lord Brahma, there's a lotus which forms and all planets appear. But it is mentioned that this happens sometimes. So in this purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions this information having come from Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. And I'll just read out what he says in his commentary to this verse and the next verse. He says, the Pitri Kalpa, which occurs at the every end of the first half of Brahma's life, is also called Padma Kalpa. And the reason why it is called Padma Kalpa is given. It is understood from this that in every Kalpa, a Kalpa is a day of Brahma. In every kalpa, a lotus which forms all the planets does not appear. It appears only sometimes. So I thought that was worth mentioning, that the lotus appears, that is meant to appear in the day of Lord Brahma, doesn't appear all the time. It appears sometimes. Why, I don't know. You can ask somebody else. So this is very, very interesting how this creation process is happening, how this time frame is being explained. And this is meant, of course, to alter our view or our conception of life in the material world. This is happening in Brahma's life. And Brahma, he also has an urgency to become Krishna conscious. And he lives for, as we mentioned, 311 trillion, 40 billion years. So he has that sense of urgency. And in the scope of eternal time, these 311 trillion years is a moment. It is nothing really. So what you speak of our 100 years? Our 100 years, if we make it to 100. I don't know many people who even make it to 100. I know one of my mentors, her mother passed away recently and she was 101. I mean, I don't know many people who make it to 100. So we have a very, very short lifespan. So there should be an urgency to alter our view of our presence in this world and what we're meant to do. Apart from the fact that there's material misery, etc., even if we remove that from the equation, we have such a very short lifespan, and our direct perspective should be become Krishna conscious as soon as possible. It is actually an urgency. If we see what is happening currently in the human civilization, in the civilized world, it is very, very shocking. And to think that we are only into the 5,000 years of Kali Yuga, that we have another 427,000 years to go. And already there is so much demonic mentality going on, there's so much hate crime, there's so much violence, there is so much violence towards different living entities, and it is all based on the bodily conception of life. That's all it's based on. It is based on color of skin, it is based on color of eyes, it is based on geographical situation, it is based on temporary things that just change with time. So, hearing these calculations of time for us in this middle planetary system should alter our view on life. We shouldn't think I have so much time left in this world. We actually don't, because we do not know when our time is going to be up, even as devotees of Krishna. It doesn't mean that as soon as we become devotees, Krishna is just going to put us in a box and we're going to be protected from everything all the time, 24/7. You'll have no accidents, you won't have any toothaches, you won't have any headaches, you're not going to feel pain and pleasure in this world, etc. That is, that's not what practicing Krishna consciousness means. It means, yes, we understand the onslaught of material nature in this world. We cultivate our attachment for Krishna and we naturally become detached from material existence. But we're still living in this world. We still have to experience heat and cold, fame, and we still experience these things, but we do not take it to be the absolute truth. We do not take temporary coming and goings of pain and pleasure as the absolute truth. We have to have a sound understanding, a clear vision of what the absolute truth is. And when we have that sound understanding, then we actually plow through life very, very steadily. Just like we see the situation with the Pandavas, not many people are subjected to that type of, I won't call it suffering, those type of obstacles in life. None of us have gone through that. None of us have been banished, right? No one has lived in the forest. We have not, who here has been, you know, if you're married, your wife hasn't, or your husband hasn't been insulted in a huge assembly, etc., etc. You haven't been ridiculed, disrespected. I mean, if we read exactly what the Pandavas and what Queen Kunti had to go through, yet they were still very, very Krishna conscious. That should be very, very humbling. So we should understand what my so-called sufferings are. Very, very minuscule. Very, very small. Sometimes it's very, very petty. I was speaking with, I don't know who I was speaking to the other day, and I was saying, my miseries or my so-called miseries are nothing in comparison to what the next person might be going through. It is actually very, very small. So whenever I think, oh, why has Krishna forsaken me, blah, blah, yada, yada, whinge, 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 cry, 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 Krishna, why me? I just think, actually, Srila Prabhupada has said so many times that he has created our good karma, and Krishna limits our amount of karmic reaction because we have come under his umbrella. So the tiny things, the tiny pins and needles we feel from the material energy, we feel from our past actions, have been reduced by Krishna. And that is Krishna's mercy. And I was thinking the other day, I heard a question, how do we know that Krishna is reciprocating? Sometimes we doubt, is Krishna actually reciprocating? I'm chanting for 2 weeks, for 2 months, for 2 years, for 5, for 10 years. How is Krishna reciprocating? I feel so alone. Krishna, where are you? Etc. Sometimes we say all these things. And I was listening to a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, and he was explaining that the first reciprocation Krishna does for you is that he gives you the association of devotees. And then Krishna reciprocates by giving you the association of a bona fide spiritual master. After that, Krishna reciprocates by giving you instructions from the spiritual master. So we might see these things of, oh yeah, it's just sadhana bhakti, you have to accept a guru, you have to have some sadhu sangha, serve the deities, come in the morning, samsara dava. You know, it's so mechanical, but these are actually ways in which Krishna is reciprocating. As you can see, this not all of Melbourne is here. But by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, we have gotten some contact with the devotee, and the devotees were so patient and tolerant with us that they gave us their association, and we developed some faith to come into the wider association of devotees and hear more about Krishna and meet a bona fide spiritual master and take initiation, and then we are fixed on our journey back home, back to Godhead. So this is Krishna's mercy. This is Krishna's reciprocation. Sometimes we doubt because we might have these ideas that reciprocation means you get your PR quickly. You get your husband. You get your wife. You get your IT job. You get all the bees to the mridanga. Krishna is reciprocating. I can play mridanga really well. Or I can play cartels and I can do it like the Mayapuris. I can. Yes, sometimes that is Krishna's mercy, but that is not how we judge based on material skill. Our material skill is not correlated with Krishna's mercy. So Krishna's mercy, it is very, very deep and profound. It changes our heart. We get purified. Our anattas start falling away in the association of devotees. So next time we might think Krishna is not reciprocating, we should just open our eyes and see where we are. And see what type of association do we have. What kind of topics, what kind of language do we use. Sometimes I myself take it for granted. I look at the life I used to live, and the things that would come out of my mouth, and those who associate with me. And it was an association of crows. Pretty much. They weren't Paramahamsa-like persons. Attached to matter. Attached to dead things. So of course that association wasn't great. And the mentality was a bodily conception. So if we just open our eyes and see where we are, and see just how opulent Krishna consciousness is in terms of the standard of life, in terms of association, and in terms of activity. It is a very, very elevated position even to be a sadhaka. Sometimes it's like, oh, I want to be a Raganuga Bhakta, I want to be so spontaneous, but even to be on the platform of sadhana bhakti is an elevated position. Because it requires certain type of regulations, certain stipulation, a certain way of life. Although it's still based on duty and commitment, there's a natural evolution of consciousness. So if we're ever in doubt, if we think Krishna is not reciprocating, just maybe look at the news and see what type of suffering is out there and how Krishna has saved us by giving us such wonderful associations, such wonderful literatures to read, a wonderful process, a safe process. And if we go through time, we look at different ways in which the world has suffered, different wars that have been fought, different wars that are being fought now in the Middle East, or in North Africa, or the war on skin disease, as I call it. Certain parts of the world, there's a skin disease situation where everything you do in life is based on your color of skin. We know famously in South Africa, this bodily consciousness was so bad that there was a brown paper bag that was used to determine whether you were a human being or a slave. So if your skin tone was the same color, then you're down there. But if your skin tone was lighter, then you're a human being. So they call it the brown paper bag. I'm not sure if they did it in slavery times in America. So this is the skin disease. We have been saved from that skin disease because we understand we're not the body. Same thing happened in America in the 1950s. And this was the first time it actually kind of shook people. Where there was a 14-year-old, what was his name? His last name was Tilly. 14-year-old African-American boy was living in Chicago, went to visit some friends, and it was still so much segregation based on the body. Segregation based on the body. And he was, he went into a shop and he kind of loosely said something to a woman who was in a lighter skin tone. And she got very offended. She called her husband. 1 week later, the husband and the brother went and harassed this young boy. And while he was alive, they took out his eyes. So his body was mutilated and obviously he died. But this was all just based on your body. We do not like you because of your body. And that is just very, very low-grade consciousness. Same thing happened a few weeks ago in Charleston in America where a young man, 21 years old, walked into a church where people were praying a Bible study. Kind of like someone walking in through here and just like shooting everybody. So 9 people were there in a Bible study. He was welcomed. He sat down. Then 1 hour later, he pulled out a rifle. He shot everyone, 6 women, 3 men. And then a grandmother and a 5-year-old acted as if they were dead. So they kind of just collapsed. And he walked out. And then he was found and he was asked, why did you do that? And he said, I don't like their skin. So this is the current state of affairs. This is the current state of body identification, that so much harm is being done to people's consciousness. And what happens is that it steeps the consciousness more and more into ignorance, because those in which the crime is being committed on start thinking, I am black, I am black, I am black, how could they? It still makes them very, very body conscious. And those who are light-skinned, they're like, oh, well, I'm like this. Everyone is body conscious. So nothing changes unless they understand the basic philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, that the body is changing all the time, that's not who you are. Unless that basic foundation is instilled in people's consciousness, there will be no change, there will be no peace. Unless we understand that we're, you know, Mama is Vamsa Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, we are eternally servants of Krishna, part and parcel of Him. We are like Him in quality. We are spiritual. Everyone is a spiritual being. So unless that changes, our conception of life, our conception of time in this world is going to be very, very warped. We'll have a warped view of what life is about. So this section where Maitreya is speaking with Vidura, talking about time, we might think, what's the big deal with time? We might think, what's the big deal with understanding all of this? But we can change our mentality. We can develop a different perception of time. And Maitreya is helping us understand that. We do not have all the time in the world. Some people say, you have all the time in the world to do this. We don't. We don't have all the time in the world. And this Krishna conscious urgency, it is there for each and every single individual. We have to become Krishna conscious to help others and to also help ourselves. So Maitreya and Vidura are discussing this repetitively. Chapter 12, chapter 13, they'll keep speaking about the same subject matters. To make an impression in our consciousness that we should not wait, we shouldn't waste the time factor, that it is Krishna's way of trying to positively push us towards purifying our consciousness and remembering that we are part and parcel of Him. So I'll stop there and ask if there's any comments or questions.
Yes, Tatiana, what do you
So sometimes when we're reaching people and we're talking about the concept that we're not the body, that we're spirit soul, and you're talking a lot about the segregation based on the bodily concept, people look at this from an externally a lot of the time. The first thing they point out is why men and women separate. That's a bodily concept. So how can we best explain that to people? Because it's different, but no, actually, like, Western, like, happened to me at Gopal's, for example, with Western audience, the first thing they say is, like, externally it seems like, you know,
okay, so how do
we explain that?
So how do we explain our separation of genders, especially for sitting, etc.?
Well, in response to that, I used to be like that. I was a very much feminist. So I used to think, equal opportunity, why can't the women do this? Why is it only the men? Blah, 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 right? Based on nothing, just hot air. To make people understand, it's very interesting that when it comes to, it's quite a history, when it comes to a spiritual group, that it's very, very easy to nitpick and find one thing you disagree with and just jump on it and chew it. That's one thing. The second thing is, even when we're out there, I remember, without Krishna consciousness, I would rather sit with my girls and do my girly thing than to have a guy here to kind of change the mood. So the whole segregation, like right now we're sitting, I wouldn't even call it segregation. The way we're sitting in class right now, just from my opinion, it's not so much segregation, because segregation denotes the other idea that we are inferior, you are superior. That's what segregation is. But here we're not. The reason, no one, who here feels inferior or superior because we're sitting separately? I don't think that consciousness is there. So out of practicality, a lot of things sometimes, it is practical reason that we sit separately. They do not say this in prison. Men and women are not mixed in prison. Do they say, oh, this is segregation? No. The women would not like to live with men in prison. Then you ask yourself, why? We want to be ourselves, we want to relax, etc. So in so many places, there is the so-called segregation. But when it comes sometimes to a spiritual group, they just jump on it. Say, but, oh, this is segregation, da-da-da-da. But for us, it's not so much segregation as a practicality. Segregation denotes many other lower qualities in consciousness. Inferiority complex is aroused with it. If you look at the men who are in prison, because there can be so much violence, because there's no control of senses, if you mix criminal minds in terms of men and women, they've seen that there will be a lot of violence. Because there's so much frustration, you're in a system and you want to take out your frustration. There's so much rape in prisons amongst same sexes. Because of they want to limit, because a prison is already intense to maintain. Now, if you want to have a situation where there are, because some of these women, it's not like they're ugly, they're very beautiful. You have beautiful women in the jail, in the bathroom. You have men who have no sense of control. What do you think is going to happen? It'll be a difficult situation to deal with. Already it's a difficult situation where you have men raping other men. It's just crazy. So to swing the female body in there, and mind you, Bhagavatam has taught us that the female form can be bewildering, is bewildering, especially to one who has no control of the senses. So if we throw all of these people together, no sense control, no strict moral codes, no fiber, there'll be even more havoc than there already is. So to try to make it a little bit more peaceful, they cannot have male and female prisoners together. It will just be difficult to control them. Yeah, that is also there. We are also, we can see ourselves, we're also in a hospital trying to get better. And sometimes we still have tendencies. So it might be easier for everyone's interest if we are not so mixed. Because we still have tendencies to want to freely mix with the opposite sex. And that's not to punish us, that is to help us grow in our Krishna consciousness. That's what I'm saying, for practical reasons. It's not to punish anyone, but practically, if you want to remain sane, it's beneficial to live like that, yeah. Even for devotees, we're not barred from it because at this point, for myself, I'm not really a Paramahamsa. When I came to Krishna consciousness, I wasn't a Paramahamsa. I had lots of things to work on, so if I had, it's very helpful to do that, to keep our senses in line, and to protect ourselves and others. Anything else before I switch this off? Thank you very much. Good choice for Baba Tanaka.
Sometimes generally come from that approach of
that one is hard, one is separate. It takes people forever to digest. That's why everyone knows that I just sit with you. You can do that. One of them is always kind of like, either the guy or the girl, they come like, hey, what's going on?